And welcome to you all. Thank you for joining us today. Out of all of the things that you could do, you've decided to join us here, and that's always a wonderful offering as well. I want us to start with a little meditation. So I'm going to invite you to find a comfortable position, whether it's sitting or laying down or standing. Maybe your legs are crossed, or maybe you're in a chair. But I invite you to find a location and a posture that feels supportive to your practice right now, and supportive and stable for your body right now. And as we settle into our body, I want to encourage you to find a sensation that you can connect to. Maybe it's a smell. Maybe it's something in your eyesight. It might be the feel of your seat, of your butt on your chair, or your feet on the floor. Other people find it helpful to connect to the feeling of the breath as it enters and leaves the body. So I'm encouraging you to just find a sensation that you can connect to and return to over and over and over again. As distractions arise, we return to the sensation. As our minds think, we return to the sensation. Remembering that minds are built to think. That's what they do. That's their intended purpose. So it's not a problem. We just don't have to attach to every thought. We can allow it to arise and pass away of its own accord. Staying anchored into the physical experience of just this moment. Anchoring ourselves with a sensation. Allowing ourselves to settle into the experience of just this moment. Not trying to turn it into something or away from something. But an invitation of allowing. An invitation of meeting this moment exactly as it is. As we settle in, can I let go of my thoughts and ideas about the experience that I'm having, the opinions I form about what's right or wrong. An invitation to just settle in, to notice, what's it like for me to have this experience? What's it like to be me? What's it like to be me in this body, in this moment? What's underneath my conceptions and ideas and opinions? Can I allow myself to continue to settle? To continue to experience my experience as I'm experiencing it? And as we settle, can we just invite in awareness of our deepest intention? And we notice that as that thought of our deepest intention arises, what's it like in my body? Is there a location for it? How do I experience this intention? Are there words attached to my intention? Or is it just feelings? Something beyond words. Maybe it's both. What's the nature of my intention? Not the specificity of the ideas and concepts, but what's the nature of it? What's it like? Continuing to stay connected to our sensation, but opening ourselves to the experience of our intention. Who do I want to be? How do I want to be? Can I allow myself to sink into that intention and let that open up the experience of myself in this moment, in this place, connected intimately with all the other intentions? I invite you to study this intention, not as a thought, but as an experience. As an invitation. As an opening. Can I listen to this intention? Can I smell the intention? Can I see the intention? Can I taste the intention? What's the nature of this experience? Is there a request in this moment? Is there instructions from the intention? Recognizing that the intention is not just a thought, but it's also a physicality. It's also an emotion. Maybe you notice yourself becoming uncomfortable. That's okay. Allow yourself to return to the sensation that anchors and roots us, that provides stability into this experience. Can I offer this intention gratitude? Can I offer gratitude to this experience? Can I notice that this intention, even without my knowing it, has led me through my life, through the good times and the difficult times, through grief and loss, depressions and anxieties, through joy and connection and intimacy. Can I notice that even when I wasn't paying attention, the intention was always there? It's not new. And it's always available. Can I allow myself I invite you now to return to your sensation, to settle in, Can I allow myself to recognize that I have all that I need? That liberation and realization are this close at hand. That they are, in fact, my experience in this moment. I invite you to slowly and gently open your eyes if they're closed. Begin to take in what's around you. Thank you all for your practice. I invite you to maybe move a minute, stretch. I'm going to start my talk off with a poem. Leave the familiar for a while. Let your senses and bodies stretch out like a welcome season onto the meadow and shores and hills. Open up to the roof. Make a new watermark on your excitement and love. Like a blooming night flower, bestow your vital fragrance of happiness and giving upon our intimate assembly. Change rooms in your mind for a day. All the hemispheres of existence lie beside an equator in your heart. Greet yourself in your thousand forms as you mount the hidden tide and travel back home. All the hemispheres in heaven are sitting around a fire chatting, while stitching themselves together into the great circle inside of you. Those are words from the mystic Hafiz. And today I want to talk about precepts and orientation and connecting to, much like we did in practice just a minute ago, to our deepest intention. So that we can allow that to carry over when we're off the cushion, when we're out of formal meditation and out living in the world. How can we allow that deepest connection to orient us and call us into relationship to the world in a different way? So in basically every stream of Buddhism, there exists a set of vows. in Theravadan traditions, the monks take, I think it's 259 vows. In the tradition I practice, Zen Buddhism, we have a total of 16 vows. And then lay people in both Theravadan and other traditions. Thank you very much. Lay people are often given what are called the five precepts. And those are, I vow not to kill. I vow not to steal. I vow not to misuse sexuality. I vow not to lie. And I vow not to intoxicate self or others. And what's interesting is, on their surface, you think, oh, these are just rules, right? And if I follow these rules, then I'm following the precepts. But if we allow these precepts to be alive, if we don't pour concrete on them and turn them into something, but instead allow them to be guideposts into the world and to guide our choices and our behaviors, what happens is so I vow not to kill becomes more than just like, I'm not going to murder people or things, but it begins to notice, well, how is it that I'm killing my spirit or I'm killing this person's dream? And killing takes on a broader idea and a broader perspective. We can also think of it in terms of, instead of I vow not to kill, I vow to love and support all beings. And how does that change it, right? Into this positive aspect. And then I can start to see, oh yeah, it's not about following rules. It's about understanding what are the ways that I exist in the world that are killing. Killing myself, killing other things, killing this, killing that. And it becomes not so much about, oh, can I move these spiders from inside my house to outside my house? But really start to think about, if this is a guidepost and I'm starting to practice and starting to try and form myself and align myself in this direction, how does that change over time as I keep practicing with it? As I keep asking myself, what's my intention around not killing? In Zen, we often think that enlightenment is merely an appropriate response. And that the precepts help us deepen and deepen and get closer and closer to each moment's appropriate response. We start to think, instead of I vow not to steal, I vow to practice generosity. Well, what does generosity mean in my experience? With all of my life causes and conditions, what are the ways that I'm generous? But also, what are the ways that I'm avaricious, that I'm greedy, I'm hoarding? What are the ways that I'm stealing? I vow to not misuse sexuality. I teach a class a lot on what it means to not misuse sexuality and to practice this precept. And it's something that we can talk about for a week and still only scratch the surface. Because we often think of this as some kind of moral test. But what's the invitation here? The invitation to have relationships that are respectful, consensual, and in accord with how I want to be in the world. I want to have relationships that honor each of us all of the people in that relationship, whether it's five people or two people or just me with myself. What does it mean not to lie? Can I not get so caught up in this idea of honesty as a practice that I forget my compassion? As an old queer person, when I first came out in the 70s, you know, we sort of trained ourselves in a way to defend ourselves from the slings and arrows of the society at large. We trained ourselves to have this sort of biting wit and being able to just be really brutal with each other. And we would call it brutal honesty. And I look back on it now and I think, no, that's just really painful. Because it's not coming from a place of love. It's coming from this place of protecting myself and teaching you how to protect yourself and wrapping myself in some kind of iron bubble that separates me from the world. So my vowing not to lie invites me into some relationship with compassionate honesty and truthfulness and integrity. Can who I am on the inside be expressed by what I do on the outside? Can I live my life with integrity? What are all the ways that I intoxicate myself? Doom scrolling on my phone. Losing myself in music and television as a way out of my own experience of the world. So we begin to notice as we orient ourselves towards our deepest intention, we begin to allow these precepts, these guideposts, to start to build guardrails for us about how we make choices in our own world, about who do I want to be in this world. And I think one of the traps of this, though, is we get caught up in this idea that somehow there's something called pure practice, or there's a hierarchy of, you know, the closer I get to this kind of ideal spiritual experience, I'm somehow going to rise above the mundane everyday existence of being me in the world. In the Mahayana tradition, we often talk about it in terms of the ultimate and the conventional. The ultimate arising of that formlessness, that liberation, the place where there is no me and you and us and them, it's all us, that we're just one thing, right? It's not that we're interconnected, but that we are all one thing. But that arises at the same time as this conventional reality that says, I live in this body, with this skin, with this history, with this socialization, with this whole sort of sets of causes and conditions based on birth and death and location, education. And so we have this ultimate formlessness that arises simultaneously with the conventional that says, I'm this white, cisgendered male person living in the United States with, you know, this amount of education and, you know, living this class life, all of these things. And these arise simultaneously. And it's in our nature to think, oh, well, the ultimate is where we want to be. So we're just going to connect to that and we're going to ignore this conventional. And we prioritize one over the other. But that's actually a misunderstanding. It's a break in the practice, because what is really true is that the only way that we experience the conventional is, or the ultimate, is through the conventional. That settling into my experience of my body and my life allows me to open up to those moments of formlessness. There are no enlightened people, only enlightened moments. And that comes about because I don't make one over the other better. Because it's also not better to sit and wallow in my experience of me as something that is unwielding and unchanging and not interconnected with all the other beings that I exist with. So I don't get to prioritize that either. There's this place where both of those exist simultaneously, and that's where we allow these guideposts to sort of aim us towards this relationship of the ultimate and the conventional. Because then we can start to see that how I live in this constructed conventional world is actually going to influence my ability to access the interconnected, formless, ultimate experience of now. And so we begin to sort of allow these precepts and these guideposts to then move us. And we start to notice things like how intention and impact exist in all of the choices that we make throughout the day. And that, yes, intention is how we create karma, but impact is how we create harm. And so I can have impact. The more that I sort of study myself as a white, cisgendered male living in America with X amount of education and blah, 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 when I study that, what's it like to be me, and I see the impacts of the world, I get to change the choices. I get to get closer and closer to an appropriate response. Because I start to see, like, oh, wait, yeah, I can interact in the world in a different way. That instead of sort of denying or pretending I don't have privilege, or that I don't have this thing, or that, you know, my queerness is not real, or my masculinity and my connections and commitments to the patriarchy aren't real. Instead, I can start to see them as real, but not unchanging. And I can begin to make choices that change my impact in the world. Can I start to notice all of the things that stand before me and my deepest intentions? What are the things that block me from living out this appropriate response And how is it that my vows can help me move beyond those limitations, beyond those barriers? Another way to think of these precepts, as of these vows, is to think of them in terms of renunciation. And we think of renunciation as something that is being given up. We're renouncing something. When I ordained and they shaved my head, you know, it was about cutting off my attachments. But the more I practice with this, with these vows, with this idea of living into what it means to, for me, to live up to my name, Great Vow, I begin to change and realize renunciation isn't about giving something up. It's about not clinging to it, about knowing that it's already gone. And that includes these ideas that I have about what it means to kill, what it means to support life, what it means to be honest. Like, I begin to renounce even my ideas about what it means to practice these precepts in such a way that then the precepts can begin to live through me rather than some set of rules that I have to follow and that will make me a good person. The truth is, we've already given everything up. And because we've already given up that stuff, they become even more precious, even more powerful. We start to notice the places where we get closer to our deepest intention and the places how we move away from it. And it's always this dance, right? The Pali language, we'll talk about kusala and akusala. Kusala is behaviors that lead us towards liberation. And akusala are behaviors that lead us away from liberation. And so we begin to ask ourselves as we make choices in each moment, did this move me closer? Or did this move me away? Can you put that in the ask a question box so I'll get to it after the talk during the Q&A session? So, akusala and kusala, are we moving towards liberation? Or are we moving away from liberation? And it's not linear. It's not like, oh, we're all, you know, the goal is to always head towards liberation. And so I'm just going to follow these rules and do these things and stick to this idea that I have about what it means to do, to follow the precepts. And that's going to lead me in this linear path from where I am to liberation. And that's actually not how practice works. It's way messier than that. How it actually works is some days I'm heading in the right directions, other days, not so much. Sometimes I'm incredibly mean and vicious, and other days I'm giving and generous. Neither one of those are me. They're just choices that I make in each moment. And because it only exists in the moment that I make that choice, I've already in the next moment, I can make a different choice. Because I can let go of my ideas about what it means to practice with these precepts. I can let go of my ideas about what it means to be a Buddhist or a Zen person or a priest or a monk. I can just, in each moment, try to find how close can I get to an appropriate response. Can I let myself be guided rather than forcing myself into some idea I have about what that means? There's a wonderful quote from Mark Epstein in Tricycle in the spring of 2005. He says, quote, "There's more to desire than just suffering. There's a yearning in desire that is as spiritual as it is sensual. Even when it degenerates into addiction, there is something salvageable from the original impulse that can only be described as sacred. Something in the person wants to be free, and it seeks its freedom any way it can." As the well-known contemporary Indian teacher Sri Nisargadatta, famous for sitting on a crowded street corner selling inexpensive biddies or Indian cigarettes, once commented, "The problem is not desire. It's that your desires are too small. The left-handed path means opening to desire so that it becomes more than just a craving for whatever the culture has conditioned us to want. Desire is a teacher. When we immerse ourselves in it without guilt, shame, or clinging, it can show us something special about our own minds that allow us to embrace life fully." So even the First Noble Truth contains this idea, we have to cut off our desire. We have to cut off this idea of clinging. But if we give up that idea that this has to be cut off and we begin to open up to the fact that, well, maybe there's education here. Maybe this can help move me along into relationship with a deeper understanding of my intention and how it is that I want to be in the world. I allow myself to be changed. I allow myself to let go and give up everything, because that then allows everything to come forth and bring itself to me. When I stop trying to control myself and the world, to create something that I think of as this spiritual life, and instead just allow my life to start to move and orient in such a way that I'm connecting to my deepest intention, and I allow that to teach me in each moment how to be the person I want to be in the world. Going back to Hafiz, leave the familiar for a while. Let your senses and bodies stretch out like a welcomed season onto the meadow and shores and hills. Open up to the roof. Make a new watermark on your excitement and love. Like a blooming night flower, bestow your vital fragrance of happiness and giving upon our intimate assembly. Change rooms in your mind for a day. All the hemispheres in existence lie beside an equator in your heart. Greet yourself in your thousand other forms as you mount the hidden tide and travel back home. All the hemispheres in heaven are sitting around a fire chatting while stitching themselves together into the great circle of you. Thank you for your attention. Thank you for your practice. I'm going to move to the questions and answers. If you want to be on screen, let Marnia know and she can invite you onto the screen. And if you, or if you're not comfortable with that, you can just ask the question in the box. And so Yang Chen asks, regarding giving up things we're attached to, I said, the truth is we've already given these things up. So what I mean by that is that we've already given up the attachment. We already have everything we need. We already are enlightened. We already are liberated. And so we practice so that we can express that in the world. And so what that means is we've already given these things up, and we practice so that we can express that giving up in the world. It's like understanding that our intention, our deepest intention, has existed inside of us since we were born. And that's always led us. But we can practice so that we can understand it and hear it a little better, and it can begin to be expressed in our life louder and more so. So it's not like we're recreating something out of something called giving up or letting go or renunciation. We're just expressing what's already happening. It's like when I was ordained, my teacher said to me, we're not starting a new thing called you as a priest or a monk. What we're doing is acknowledging that you practice in this way already, that you already are this thing. And so, you know, that's, we already are everything. We're just learning how to express it. And so that's why we practice. And so so that's the same thing. We give up knowing that we've already given it up. It's just, how do I express that giving it up in the world? I really appreciate that question because I think it's a really great question. Anyone else? And feel, it's lovely when people are courageous enough to come onto screen and ask their question. Or you can ask again, ask the question box. And I will say, it's always hardest to be the first. Maybe you'd like to express something that, a new learning that you had, or your experience. What was the meditation like for you? Great question. So how do we balance our needs against those of others, especially if we're helping people? How do we prioritize ourselves versus others, et cetera, et cetera? So here's a really interesting thing. Boundaries are necessary so that I can love you and myself at the same time. And so that's how we balance my own needs with other people's needs, is trying to figure out how it, so I work as a chaplain, right? And so I'm really clear when I go to sit at somebody's bedside as they're dying, or I meet with the family, what happens is I realize that I'm there to meet their needs, right? Like, that's my job. And my practice is what brings me there. But then what happens there is about them. And so that boundary exists so that I don't confuse them with me. Because it's not about my practice or my ideas or my understanding or anything else. It's about the person I'm serving. And I think of it in terms of service and not help, because I think that's the other thing. Helping means there's this imbalance of power structure and I'm somehow giving you something that you don't have. And I'm the helper and you're the victim or the person who needs help. Whereas if I'm in service, that means that everybody is getting served. And service just means I'm helping you express what you already have while I express what I already have. And so together we're expressing what already exists. And so I think boundaries are super important and super useful. And that helps us too, because what's interesting is, so for instance, with my family and I have a really difficult, constrained relationship. They're super conservative. And have a problem with my being queer, let alone that I'm now a Buddhist and that I'm a monk and all of these things. And so when we interact, I have really clear boundaries about things. And so, you know, if they're starting off on a tangent that I can't support or agree with, then I can just go, okay, I'm going to go and I'll talk to you later. And I hang up the phone or I leave the room, you know, like I don't have to participate in these conversations. And it's a boundary I have. And what's interesting is over the years, as I've lived up to this boundary, my family has begun to change, at least in the way that they interact with me or when I'm around. I don't know what they do when I'm not there. But because I've had these boundaries where I live in such a way that I can love them and myself at the same time, they've begun to interact in a different way with me. And I like to think that that's had some kind of positive impact on their life. Because I don't go in there thinking that I have to change them or that I have to change their mind or that any of that. That's not my job. I'm just there practicing what I practice. And sometimes that means I have to walk away. I think the biggest lessons for Buddhists often can be that I can love you from 300 feet away. And, you know, and it's really funny because at first they were very confused because I didn't fight. We used to fight a lot. And then I stopped fighting with them and they got really confused. And at one point, my mom was like, why do you keep leaving? And I said, well, I leave so that I can come back. Because if I don't leave, I'm not going to come back, right? And she was like, oh, wow, okay. And then I only visit for like 3 days max. And at one point she asked me about that. And I said, well, because if I stay longer than 3 days, we hate each other at the end and we don't speak for about a month. And I'd rather keep speaking to you. So I just stay as long as I can put up with it. And so that's how we do this balancing of helping my own needs versus everything else. Oh, this is such a beautiful question. This question is, how do I balance being relaxed and my sensitive self? I think we balance who we are with who we want to be when we realize that we are who we want to be already. And that the practice is in just expressing it. So my entire life, I've been told, oh, you're so sensitive, or you're so overly blah, blah, you know, like you're too much, or all of the things, right? And I think that what's really beautiful is when I just start to go, okay, so what? I'm just going to be sensitive. I don't have, like, why is it that being a sensitive person has to be in opposition to my being at ease in my own life? That's some story I picked up. So I can let that story go, and I can just stop fighting myself and just be like, okay, so I'm a sensitive person. Great. And what knocks me off of being relaxed in my own life, being at ease in my own life, is thinking that I have to somehow be different than what I am. I was having a conversation yesterday with a friend about my ADHD, my anxiety, and my depression. And we were talking, and I said, when I was living in the temple and I was in training, and I used to go into my teacher's office and be like, I'm struggling with blah, 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 blah. I'm really struggling with my depression. I feel like I can't move. It feels like I'm under molasses. I'm really struggling. And he said, why are you struggling? And I was like, what do you mean? And he said, just be depressed. Like, you can be depressed and do these things you need to do. Just be depressed. You're depressed. So what? You're anxious. So what? Because when I stop fighting my own experience, when I stop fighting my own self, I have so much more room to not be dragged around by it. See, when I'm trying to deny it or change it or make it into something else, I don't have the energy to not then be dragged around by it. So when I stop fighting it, I'm like, okay, so I'm really depressed. And I have to go to work. And I have to do this thing. I can be depressed and. Whereas if I'm fighting my depression, if I'm struggling with my depression, I'm just depressed. Did that help? Hopefully, yes. Oh my gosh. Henry, this is such a beautiful thing. This idea of the spiritual life separate from my own life, and I use it as a stick to beat myself up with. That is so, I think it's a really common thing that we do, right? Like, we use the precepts, we use this idea, these guideposts. And it's a very sort of Western Christian idea that when we fall short of some ideal, we're not doing enough. And so therefore we've got to beat ourselves up. And so I think when we start to realize that, again, it's not about right or wrong, right? There's no right way to live not killing things. There's just deepening and allowing ourselves to understand every day what it means to not kill. And so then I begin to move closer and closer to, so I allow these things to live through me rather than as some kind of weapon against myself. And, but it also happened. I have this idea of what it means to be a chaplain. I have this idea of what it means to be a Zen priest, what it means to be an activist, what it means to be a teacher. And then when I don't do those things, I think, oh, I failed. No, I'm just a dude trying, you know, I'm just another person trying to live out my life in a way that is in accord with coming closer and closer and closer to an appropriate response. Sometimes I'm really good at it and I'm right there, and other times I'm not. Neither one is a deal breaker, because in the next moment I can change and make a different choice. And so, but if I believe, if I believed everything that people say about me, if I believe that I was a piece of shit when I fall short, then I have to believe that I'm, you know, some transcendent thing when I do something right, right? And neither one of those are actually helpful to me being a better person in the world on a day-to-day basis. So again, if we use them as a way to orient ourselves and as guideposts rather than laws and rules, the stick becomes a little softer. And then eventually we begin to realize, like, I don't need that stick anymore, because it's not about, it's not linear. I know people who have practiced for 50 years who suck at being people. And that's okay. Because I don't know what they were like 50 years ago. So maybe this is the better way to be. Is our deepest intention the same for everyone? No. Your deepest intention is your deepest intention. How that expresses itself is because it's created by the causes and conditions of your own lived experience. Your deepest intention can only be connected to your individual existence, because nobody else has that particular set of causes and conditions. And so it's easy. So for a lot of times when I think about for myself, what's my deepest intention? It's not like a sentence comes to mind and I think this thing. It's actually more of a feeling, of an emotion. And I often feel it in my stomach as a sort of pulling, right? Like I'm being pulled emotionally into a particular direction. Or sometimes I feel it when I'm sitting across from someone who's dying, and I just feel the urge to speak these words. So there's no thought. It's just a, and then other times I have these really big ideals that are sort of really big thoughts, and they're words, and I see pictures and all of the things. But our deepest intention is really just, what does it mean to live authentically as myself in the world? And what does that ask of me? My teacher often asks, what does your practice ask of you? In this moment, what's your practice at? And that's how we connect to our deepest intention, because it is connected to how we practice, who we are, the causes and conditions of our life, and also what this moment is presenting to us, because our deepest intention is always changing, because it's always in relationship to the people we're with, the causes and conditions, and this moment. Did that make sense? And if it didn't make sense, feel free to ask more in the question box. We have about 15 more minutes. Oh, yeah. Thank you very much, Yang Chen. Can I allow myself? I've been practicing with this idea of invitation lately, rather than instructions, but to think in terms of invitation. And so rather than what's my vow asking of me right now, I think, what's my vow inviting me into? What's my intention inviting me towards? And so, yeah, it's funny because I started off that sentence started off with as a whole sentence. And then when I said the words out loud, can I allow myself? I just couldn't say the rest of the words. And so that, again, that's that coming closer and closer to an appropriate response, right? Like, I let go of my agenda and my idea well enough to just end it where it needed to end, which was, can I allow myself? And it spoke to me too. Like, if you notice, I had a little choke there. Like, it tapped into something I needed to hear. So, yeah. Thank you very much. Yes, exactly. It was a complete question. And that's, you know, that's what it means to give up, right? Like, I gave up my idea that I somehow had to stick to some script I had in my mind, because when the word was actually happening, the word said what they needed to say, rather than my trying to make them say something that I thought they needed to say. We have time for one more. And it'd be great. Oh, there we go. Thank you very much. That's very kind of you. And I try really hard to not attach too much to, I think, as, and this is just my own opinion, as the way teachers get in trouble is when they think they are teachers. You know, when they think that because I do this thing well, that somehow means I have achieved something. And so I just feel like, yeah. I just feel like I just do the best I can, and sometimes it's good and sometimes it's not. Hopefully when it's in public, it's good. That's my hope. So thank you very much. I really appreciate that compliment. How about from somebody who normally doesn't speak up or ask questions? Oh, wow. Yeah. Oh, that. I can't tell you whether or not that's not being honest. Only you can tell yourself whether or not that's not being honest, because it's in relationship to, like, your own deepest intention. And especially with things like honesty, like, sometimes honesty has to be handled with compassion too. Like, it's not just honesty. It's compassionate honesty. And so sometimes the compassionate thing is to confront somebody. You know, if somebody's being racist or saying hurtful things or whatever, then it's important sometimes to confront them and say, you know, I'm just not willing to sit through your racism anymore. And so when you do that, I'm going to get up and leave and I'll come back. I'm not ending our relationship, but I just don't want to be around that. And so that's a compassionate honesty piece, right? But maybe it's something else simple, like, I think you're a lousy driver. And is that really helpful? Is that going to be beneficial? So, you know, figuring out what's the compassionate thing here, not just compassion for myself, but also compassion for them. And both of those have to be true. And so I can't tell you whether or not it's being dishonest. I will say that I think you already know the answer and that you should just trust yourself and trust your own heart and trust your practice. I hope that was helpful. Oh my gosh. That is such a great statement. Intimate with ourselves. So there's an old koan that basically says, a monk goes to his teacher and says, what is the business under the robe? Meaning, what is this? What is it that we're doing here? What does it mean to practice? And the teacher says, intimacy. And of course, and as is often the case in koans, the monk was immediately enlightened and everybody lived happily ever after. But this question of intimacy, like, if you think about it, practice is simply becoming more and more intimate with ourselves, because it always starts here, right? It always exists in this body, in this moment. So practice is all about developing deeper and deeper intimacy. And I would imagine that the more you practice, the more intimate you feel with yourself. And so I would say, just keep practicing and recognize that practice is developing intimacy with yourself. Because since we're not trying to change our experience, if we're not trying to create special thoughts, since we're not trying to escape our experience, but really experience our experience, it is all about developing that intimate connection to yourself and connecting to, and from that deepening and deepening and deepening intimate connection, then you'll become more and more aware of what these precepts mean to you, your deepest intention. Like, it's not linear, but it is cumulative in this weird kind of way. Because the more you practice, the more consistent you are with the practice, the more intimate you become with yourself, the more you stop fighting your own experience and stop fighting yourself, the more intimate you come with yourself. And those of us who are hard on ourselves, who are always self-critical, it's really hard to then, like, think about it. I don't want to be intimate with people who are critical of me. So when I'm super critical of myself, I don't want to be intimate with myself. So that's part of this process, is to just see if I can visit underneath the criticism long enough to connect to something deeper. And it is an intimate practice, because it all starts in this skin bag, in this body, with this mind, in this state, in this moment. I hope that was helpful. I want to thank you all for your very kind attention, for your practice. I want to offer the merit of our time together and whatever may have arisen to the benefit of all beings, and in particular those beings experiencing war and violence. May we continue to find peaceful solutions. And I want to put in another plug for Donna and Generosity. As a teacher who wants to exist outside of a capitalist model, Donna is really important. You're not paying for the teachings. You're supporting my livelihood so that I can continue to offer the teachings. And everything I do is based on your generosity. And without your generosity, these places don't exist, especially on the internet, because it's difficult. And so if you would be as generous as it is possible, everybody is invited, and there is no gift that is too small. And if you can't give financially, you can give a blessing, you can give a prayer, you can give an offering of kindness. And with that, I'll say thank you very much. May you all be well, and I hope to see you again soon.